Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. The Hilton's Holiday by Sarah Orne Jewett. 1. There was a bright full moon in the clear sky, and the sunset was still shining faintly in the west. Dark woods stood all about the old Hilton farmhouse, save down the hill, westward, where lay the shadowy fields which John Hilton, and his father before him, had cleared and tilled with much toil, the small fields to which they had given the industry and even affection of their honest lives. John Hilton was sitting on the doorstep of his house. As he moved his head in and out of the shadows, turning now and then to speak to his wife, who sat just within the doorway, one could see his good face, rough and somewhat unkempt, as if he were indeed a creature of the shady woods and brown earth instead of the noisy town. It was late in the long spring evening, and he had just come from the lower field as cheerful as a boy, proud of having finished the planting of his potatoes. "I had to do my last row mostly by feelin'," he said to his wife. "I'm proper glad I pushed through and went back and ended off after supper. 'Twould have taken me a good part of tomorrow mornin' and broke my day." "'Tain't no use for ye to work yourself all to pieces, John,' answered the woman quickly. "'I declare it does seem harder than ever that we couldn't have kept our boy. "'He'd been coming 14 years old this fall, most a grown man, "'and he'd work right alongside of ye now the whole time. "'Twas hard to lose him. "'I do seem to miss little John,' said the father sadly. "'I expect there were reasons why 'twas best. "'I feel able and smart to work. "'My father was a girt strong man and a monstrous worker afore me.' "'Tain't that, but I was a-thinkin' myself today what a sight of company the boy would have been. You know, small's he was, how I could trust him to leave anywheres with the team, and how he beseech us to go with me wherever I was going, always right in my tracks, I used to tell him. Poor little John, for all he was so young, he had a great deal of judgment. He had made a likely man.' The mother sighed heavily as she sat within the shadow. "'But then there's a little girl's a sight of help and company,' urged the father eagerly, as if it were wrong to dwell upon sorrow and loss. "'Katie, she's most as good as a boy, except she ain't very rugged. She's a real little farmer. She's helped me a sight this spring, and you've got Susan Ellen. That makes a complete little housekeeper for ye as far as she's learnt. I don't see, but we're better off than most folks, each on us having a workmate.' "'That's so, John,' acknowledged Mrs. Hilton wistfully, beginning to rock steadily in her straight, splint-bottomed chair. It was always a good sign when she rocked. "'Where be the little girls so late?' asked their father. "'Tis getting long past 8 o'clock. I don't know when we've all set up so late, but it's so kind of summer-like and pleasant. Why, where be they gone?' "'I told ye, only over to Becker's folks,' answered the mother. "'I don't see myself what keeps them so late. They beseeched me after supper till I let 'em go.' "'They're all in a dazzle with the new teacher. "'She asked him to come over. "'They say she's unusual smart with arithmetic, "'but she has a kind of gorpin look to me. "'She's going to give Katie some pieces for her doll, "'but I told Katie she ought to be ashamed "'wantin' doll's pieces, big as she's getting to be. "'I don't know she's aught, though. "'She ain't but 9 this summer. "'Let her take her comfort,' said the kind-hearted man. "'Them things draws her to the teacher and makes him acquainted.' "'Katie's shy with new folks, more so in Susan Ellen, who's of the business kind. "'Katie's shy-feeling and wishful.' "'I don't know, but she is,' agreed the mother slowly. "'Ain't it singular how well acquainted you be with that one, and I with Susan Ellen? "'Twas always so from the first. "'I'm doubtful sometimes our Katie ain't one that'll be like to get married. "'Anyways, not about here. "'She lives right with herself, but Susan Ellen ain't nothing when she's alone. "'She's always after company.' All the boys is waitin' on her already. I ain't afraid but she'll take her pick when the time comes. I expect to see Susan Ellen well settled. She feels grown up now. But Katie don't care one mite about none of them things. She wants to be rovin' outdoors. I do believe she'd stand and hark to a bird the whole forenoon. Perhaps she'll grow up to be a teacher, suggested John Hilton. She takes to her books more'n the other one. I should like one on 'em to be a teacher, same's as my mother was. They're good girls as anybody's got. So they be, said the mother, with unusual gentleness, and the creak of her rocking chair was heard, regular as the ticking of a clock. The night breeze stirred in the great woods, and the sound of a brook that went falling down the hillside grew louder and louder. Now and then one could hear the plaintive chirp of a bird. The moon glittered with whiteness like a winter moon, and shone upon the low-roofed house until its small window panes gleamed like silver, and one could almost see the colors of a blooming bush of lilac that grew in a sheltered angle by the kitchen door. There was an incessant sound of frogs in the lowlands. "Be you sound asleep, John?" asked the wife presently. "I don't know but what I was, almost," said the tired man, starting a little. "I should laugh if I was to fall sound asleep right here on the step. 'Tis the bright night, I expect, makes my eyes feel heavy, and 'tis so peaceful. I was up and dressed a little past 4, and out to work." "Well, well," and he laughed sleepily and rubbed his eyes. "Where's the little girls? I'd better step along and meet 'em." "I wouldn't just yet. They'll get home all right, but 'tis late for 'em, certain. I don't want 'em keeping Miss Becker's folks up, neither." "There, let's wait a few minutes," urged Mrs. Hilton. "I've been a-thinking all day I'd like to give the children some kind of a treat," said the father, wide awake now. "I hurried up my work 'cause I had it so in mind. They don't have the opportunities some do, and I want 'em to know the world, and not stay right here on the farm like a couple of bushes." "They're a sight better off not to be so full of notions as some is," protested the mother suspiciously. "Certain," answered the farmer, "but they're good, bright children, and commencing to take a sight of notice. I want 'em to have all we can give 'em. I want 'em to see how other folks does things." "Why, so do I." Here the rocking chair stopped ominously. "But so as long as they're contented." "Contented ain't all in this world. Hopper toads may have that quality and spend all their time a blinkin'. I don't know's being contented is all there is to look for in a child. Ambition's something to me. Now you've got your mind on to some plot or other." The rocking chair began to move again. "Why can't you talk right out?" "'Tain't nothing special," answered the good man, a little ruffled. He was never prepared for his wife's mysterious powers of divination. "Well, there, you do find things out the master. I only thought perhaps I'd take him tomorrow and go off somewhere if 'twas a good day. I've been promising for a good while I'd take him to Topham Corners. They've never been there since they was very small." "I believe you want a good time yourself. You ain't never got over being a boy." Mrs. Hilton seemed much amused. "There, go if you want to and take him. They've got their summer hats and new dresses. I don't know of nothing that stands in the way. I should sense it better if there was a circus or anything to go to. Why don't you wait and let the girls pick 'em some strawberries or nice raspberries, and then they could take and sell 'em to the stores?" John Hilton reflected deeply. "I should like to get me some good yellow turnip seed to plant late. I ain't more'n satisfied with what I've been getting of late years, Irish speed. And I'm going to provide me with a good hoe. Mine's getting wore out and all shackly. I can't seem to fix it good." "Them's excuses," observed Mrs. Hilton with friendly tolerance. "You just cover up the hoe with something. If you get it, I would. Iris Speed's so jealous he'll remember it of you this 20 year you're going and buying a new hoe, anybody but him." "I always thought 'twas a free country," said John Hilton soberly. "I don't want to vex Ira neither. He favors us all he can in trade. 'Tis difficult for him to spare a cent, but he's as honest as daylight." At this moment there was a sudden sound of young voices, and a pair of young figures came out from the shadow of the woods into the moon-lighted open space. An old cock crowed loudly from his perch in the shed, as if he were a herald of royalty. The little girls were hand in hand, and a brisk young dog capered about them as they came. "Wasn't it dark getting home through the woods this time of night?" asked the mother hastily, and not without reproach. "I don't love to have you gone so late. Mother and me was timid about ye, and you've kept Miss Becker's folks up, I expect," said their father regretfully. "I don't want to have it said that my little girls ain't got good manners." "The teacher had a party," chirped Susan Ellen, the elder of the two children. "Going home from school, she asked the Grover boys and Mary and Sarah Speed, and Miss Becker was real pleasant to us. She passed round some cake and handed us sap sugar on one of her best plates, and we played games and sung some pieces, too. Miss Becker thought we did real well. I can pick out most of a tune on the cabinet organ. Teacher says she'll give me lessons." "I want to know, dear," exclaimed John Hilton. "Yes, and we played Copenhagen and took side spellin', and Katie beat everybody spellin' there was there." Katie had not spoken. She was not so strong as her sister, and while Susan Ellen stood a step or two away addressing her eager little audience, Katie had seated herself close to her father on the doorstep. He put his arm around her shoulder and drew her close to his side, where she stayed. "Ain't you got nothing to tell, daughter?" he asked, looking down fondly, and Katie gave a pleased little sigh for answer. "Tell him what's going to be the last day of school and about our trimming the schoolhouse," she said, and Susan Ellen gave the program in most spirited fashion. "'Twill be a great time," said the mother when she had finished. "I don't see why folks want to go traipsing off to strange places when such things is happening right about 'em." But the children did not observe her mysterious air. "Come, you must step yourselves right to bed." They all went into the dark, warm house. The bright moon shone upon it steadily all night, and the lilac flowers were shaken by no breath of wind until early dawn. 2. The Hiltons always waked early. So did their neighbors, the crows and song sparrows and robins, the light-footed foxes and squirrels in the woods. When John Hilton waked before 5 o'clock, an hour later than usual because he had sat up so late, he opened the house door and came out into the yard, crossing the short green turf hurriedly as if the day were too far spent for any loitering. The magnitude of the plan for taking a whole day of pleasure confronted him seriously, but the weather was fair, and his wife, whose disapproval could not have been set aside, had accepted and even smiled upon the great project. It was inevitable now that he and the children should go to Topham Corners. Mrs. Hilton had the pleasure of waking them and telling the news. In a few minutes they came frisking out to talk over the great plans. The cattle were already fed and their father was milking. The only sign of high festivity was a wagon pulled out into the yard, with both seats put in as if it were Sunday. But Mr. Hilton still wore his everyday clothes, and Susan Ellen suffered instantly from disappointment. "Ain't we going, Father?" she asked complainingly, but he nodded and smiled at her, even though the cow, impatient to get to pasture, kept whisking her rough tail across his face. He held his head down and spoke cheerfully in spite of this vexation. "Yes, sister, we're going certain, and going to have a great time, too." Susan Ellen thought that he seemed like a boy at that delightful moment, and felt new sympathy and pleasure at once. "You go and help mother about breakfast and them things. We want to get off quick so we can. You coax mother now, both on ye, and see if she won't go with us." "She said she wouldn't be hired to," responded Susan Ellen. "She says it's going to be hot, and she's laid out to go over and see how her Aunt Tanson Brooks is this afternoon." The father gave a little sigh, then he took heart again. The truth was that his wife made light of the contemplated pleasure, and much as he usually valued her companionship and approval, it was sure that they should have a better time without her. It was impossible, however, not to feel guilty of disloyalty at the thought. Even though she might be completely unconscious of his best ideals, he only loved her and the ideals the more, and bent his energies to satisfying her indefinite expectations. His wife still kept much of that youthful beauty which Susan Ellen seemed likely to reproduce. An hour later the best wagon was ready and the great expedition set forth. The little dog sat apart and barked as if it fell entirely upon him to voice the general excitement. Both seats were in the wagon, but the empty place testified to Mrs. Hilton's unyielding disposition. She had wondered why one broad seat would not do, but John Hilton meekly suggested that the wagon looked better. The little girls sat on the back seat dressed alike in their Sunday hats of straw with blue ribbons, and their little plaid shawls pinned neatly about their small shoulders. They wore gray thread gloves and sat very straight. Susan Ellen was half a head the taller, but otherwise from behind they looked much alike. As for their father, he was in his Sunday best, a plain black coat and a winter hat of felt, which was heavy and rusty-looking for that warm early summer day. He had it in mind to buy a new straw hat at Topham, so that this, with the turnip seed and the hoe, made 3 important reasons for going. "Remember and lay off your shawls when you get there, and carry 'em over your arm," said the mother, clucking like an excited hen to her chickens. "They'll do to keep the dust off your new dresses going and coming. And when you eat your dinners, don't get spots on you, and don't point at folks as you ride by and stare, or they'll know you came from the country. And John, you call in to Cousin Adeline Marlowe's and see how they all be, and tell her I expect her over certain to stop a while before haying. It always eases her tisic to get up here on the highland, and I've got a new notion about doing over her best room carpet since I seen her that'll save ripping one breadth. And don't come home all wore out, and John, don't you go and buy me no kickshaws to fetch home. I ain't a child, and you ain't got no money to waste. I expect you'll go, like snot, and buy you some kind of a foolish boy's hat. Do look and see if it's reasonable good straw, and won't splinter all off round the edge. And you mind, John?" "Yes, yes, hold on," cried John impatiently. Then he cast a last affectionate, reassuring look at her face, flushed with the hurry and responsibility of starting them off in proper shape. "I wish you was going, too," he said, smiling. "I do so." Then the old horse started, and they went out at the bars, and began the careful long descent of the hill. The young dog, tethered to the lilac bush, was frantic with piteous appeals. The little girls piped their eager goodbyes again and again, and their father turned many times to look back and wave his hand. As for their mother, she stood alone and watched them out of sight. There was one place far out on the high road where she could catch a last glimpse of the wagon, and she waited what seemed a very long time until it appeared and then was lost to sight again behind a low hill. "They are nothing but a pack of children together," she said aloud, and then felt lonelier than she expected. She even stooped and patted the unresigned little dog as she passed him, going into the house. The occasion was so much more important than anyone had foreseen that both the little girls were speechless. It seemed at first like going to church in new clothes or to a funeral. They hardly knew how to behave at the beginning of a whole day of pleasure. They made grave bows at such persons of their acquaintance as happened to be straying in the road. Once or twice they stopped before a farmhouse while their father talked an inconsiderately long time with someone about the crops and the weather, and even dwelt upon town business and the doings of the selectmen, which might be talked of at any time. The explanations that he gave of their excursion seemed quite unnecessary. It was made entirely clear that he had a little business to do at Topham Corners, and thought he had better give the little girls a ride. They had been very steady at school, and he had finished planting, and could take the day as well as not. Soon, however, they all felt as if such an excursion were an everyday affair, and Susan Ellen began to ask eager questions, while Katie silently sat apart enjoying herself as she never had done before. She liked to see the strange houses and the children who belonged to them. It was delightful to find flowers that she knew growing all along the road, no matter how far she went from home. Each small homestead looked its best and pleasantest, and shared the exquisite beauty that early summer made, shared the luxury of greenness and flowerness that decked the rural world. There was an early peony or a late lilac in almost every dooryard. It was 17 miles to Topham. After a while they seemed very far from home, having left the hills far behind, and descended to a great level country with fewer tracts of woodland, and wider fields where the crops were much more forward. The houses were all painted, and the roads were smoother and wider. It had been so pleasant driving along that Katie dreaded going into the strange town when she first caught sight of it, though Susan Ellen kept asking with bold fretfulness if they were not almost there. They counted the steeples of 4 churches, and their father presently showed them the Topham Academy, where their grandmother once went to school, and told them that perhaps one day they would go there too. Katie's heart gave a strange leap. It was such a tremendous thing to think of, but instantly the suggestion was transformed for her into one of the certainties of life. She looked with solemn awe at the tall belfry and the long rows of windows in the front of the academy, there where it stood high and white among the clustering trees. She hoped that they were going to drive by, but something forbade her from taking the responsibility of saying so. Soon the children found themselves among the crowded village houses. Their father turned to look at them with affectionate solicitude. "Now sit up straight and appear pretty," he whispered to them. "We're among the best people now, and I want folks to think well of you." "I guess we're just as good as they be," remarked Susan Ellen, looking at some innocent passers-by with dark suspicion. But Katie tried indeed to sit straight and folded her hands prettily in her lap and wished with all her heart to be pleasing for her father's sake. Just then an elderly woman saw the wagon and the sedate party it carried, and smiled so kindly that it seemed to Katie as if Topham Corners had welcomed and received them. She smiled back again, as if this hospitable person were an old friend, and entirely forgot that the eyes of all Topham had been upon her. "There, now we're coming to an elegant house that I want you to see. You'll never forget it," said John Hilton. It's where Judge Masterson lives, the great lawyer, the handsomest house in the county, everybody says. Do you know him, Father? Asked Susan Ellen. I do, answered John Hilton proudly. Him and my mother went to school together in their young days and were always called the two best scholars of their time. The judge called to see her once. He stopped to our house to see her when I was a boy. And then some years ago, you've heard me tell how I was on the jury, and when he heard my name spoken, he looked at me sharp and asked if I wasn't the son of Catherine Wynne, and spoke most beautiful of your grandmother and how well he remembered their young days together. I like to hear about that, said Katie. She had it pretty hard, I'm afraid, up on the old farm. She was keeping school in our district when Father married her. That's the main reason I backed 'em down when they wanted to tear the old schoolhouse all to pieces, confided John Hilton, turning eagerly. They all say she lived longer up here on the hill than she could anywhere, but she never had her health. I wasn't but a boy when she died. Father and me lived alone afterward till the time your mother come. 'Twas a good while, too. I wasn't married so young as some. 'Twas lonesome, I tell you. My father was plumb discouraged losing of his wife, and her long sickness and all set him back, and we'd work all day on the land and never say a word. I suppose 'tis being so lonesome early in life that makes me so pleased to have some nice girls growing up around me now. There was a tone in her father's voice that drew Katie's heart toward him with new affection. She dimly understood, but Susan Ellen was less interested. They had often heard the story before, but to one child it was always new, and to the other old. Susan Ellen was apt to think it tiresome to hear about her grandmother, who, being dead, was hardly worth talking about. "There's Judge Masterson's place," said their father in an everyday manner, as they turned a corner and came into full view of the beautiful old white house standing behind its green trees and terraces and lawns. The children had never imagined anything so stately and fine, and even Susan Ellen exclaimed with pleasure. At that moment they saw an old gentleman, who carried himself with great dignity, coming slowly down the wide box-bordered path toward the gate. "There he is now! There's the judge!" whispered John Hilton excitedly, reining his horse quickly to the green roadside. "He's going downtown to his office. We can wait right here and see him. I can't expect him to remember me. It's been a good many years. Now you are going to see the great Judge Masterson." There was a quiver of expectation in their hearts. The judge stopped at his gate, hesitating a moment before he lifted the latch, and glanced up the street at the country wagon with its two prim little girls on the back seat, and the eager man who drove. They seemed to be waiting for something. The old horse was nibbling at the fresh roadside grass. The judge was used to being looked at with interest, and responded now with a smile as he came out to the sidewalk and unexpectedly turned their way. Then he suddenly lifted his hat with grave politeness and came directly toward them. "Good morning, Mr. Hilton," he said. "I'm very glad to see you, sir." And Mr. Hilton, the little girl's own father, took off his hat with equal courtesy and bent forward to shake hands. Susan Ellen cowered and wished herself away, but little Katie sat straighter than ever, with joy in her father's pride and pleasure shining in her pale, flower-like little face. "These are your daughters, I am sure," said the old gentleman kindly, taking Susan Ellen's limp and reluctant hand. But when he looked at Katie, his face brightened. "How she recalls your mother," he said with great feeling. "I'm glad to see this dear child. You must come to see me with your father, my dear," he added, still looking at her. "Bring both little girls and let them run about the old garden. The cherries will soon be getting ripe," said Judge Masterson hospitably. "Perhaps you will have time to stop this afternoon as you go home?" "I should call it a great pleasure if you would come and see us again some time. You may be driving our way, sir," said John Hilton. "Not very often in these days," answered the old judge. "I thank you for the kind invitation. I should like to see the fine view again from your hill westward. Can I serve you in any way while you're in town? Goodbye, my little friends." Then they parted, but not before Katie, the shy Katie, whose hand the judge still held unconsciously while he spoke, had reached forward as he said goodbye and lifted her face to kiss him. She could not have told why, except that she felt drawn to something in the serious, worn face. For the first time in her life, the child had felt the charm of manners. Perhaps she owned a kinship between that which made him what he was, and the spark of nobleness and purity in her own simple soul. She turned again and again to look back at him as they drove away. "Now you have seen one of the first gentlemen of the country," said their father. "It was worth coming twice as far." But he did not say any more, nor turn as usual to look in the children's faces. In the chief business street of Topham, a great many country wagons like the Hiltons were fastened to the posts, and there seemed to our holiday-makers to be a great deal of noise and excitement. "Now I've got to do my errands, and we can let the horse rest and feed," said John Hilton. "I'll slip his headstall right off and put on his halter. I'm going to buy him a real good treat of oats. First we'll go and buy me my straw hat. I feel as if this one looked a little past to wear on Topham. We'll buy the things we want, and then we'll walk all along the street so you can look in the windows and see the handsome things, same's your mother likes to. What was it your mother told you about your shawls?" "To take them off and carry 'em over our arms," piped Susan Ellen, without comment. But in the interest of alighting and finding themselves afoot upon the pavement, the shawls were forgotten. The children stood at the doorway of a shop while their father went inside, and they tried to see what the Topham shapes of bonnets were like, as their mother had advised them. But everything was exciting and confusing, and they could arrive at no decision. When Mr. Hilton came out with a hat in his hand to be seen in a better light, Katie whispered that she wished he would buy a shiny one like Judge Masterson's. But her father only smiled and shook his head and said that they were plain folks, he and Katie. There were dry goods for sale in the same shop, and a young clerk who was measuring linen kindly pulled off some pretty labels with gilded edges and gay pictures and gave them to the little girls, to their exceeding joy. He may have had small sisters at home, this friendly lad, for he took pains to find two pretty blue boxes besides, and was rewarded by their beaming gratitude. It was a famous day. They even became used to seeing so many people pass. The village was full of its morning activity, and Susan Ellen gained a new respect for her father, and an increased sense of her own consequence, because even in Topham several persons knew him and called him familiarly by name. The meeting with an old man who had once been a neighbor seemed to give Mr. Hilton the greatest pleasure. The old man called to them from a house doorway as they were passing, and they all went in. The children seated themselves wearily on the wooden step, but their father shook his old friend eagerly by the hand and declared that he was delighted to see him so well and enjoying the fine weather. "Oh, yes," said the old man in a feeble, quavering voice. "I'm astonishing well for my age. I don't complain, John. I don't complain." They talked long together of people whom they had known in the past, and Katie, being a little tired, was glad to rest, and sat still with her hands folded, looking about the front yard. There were some kinds of flowers that she had never seen before. "This is the one that looks like my mother," her father said, and touched Katie's shoulder to remind her to stand up and let herself be seen. "Judge Masterson saw the resemblance. We met him at his gate this morning." "Yes, she certainly does look like your mother, John," said the old man, looking pleasantly at Katie, who found that she liked him better than at first. "She does, certain. The best of young folks is. They remind us of the old ones. 'Tis natural to cling to life, folks say, but for me I get impatient at times. Most everybody's gone now, and I want to be going. 'Tis something before me, and I want to have it over with. I want to be there long of the rest of the folks. I expect to last quite a while, though. I may see you a couple of times more, John." John Hilton responded cheerfully, and the children were urged to pick some flowers. The old man awed them with his impatience to be gone. There was such a townful of people about him, and he seemed as lonely as if he were the last survivor of a former world. Until that moment they had felt as if everything was just beginning. "Now I want to buy something pretty for your mother," said Mr. Hilton, as they went soberly away down the street, the children keeping fast hold of his hands. "By now the old horse will have eat his dinner and had a good rest, so pretty soon we can jog along home. I'm going to take you round by the academy and the old North meeting house where Dr. Barstow used to preach. Can't you think of something that your mother'd want?" he asked suddenly, confronted by a man's difficulty of choice. "She was talking about wanting a new pepper box one day. The top of the old one won't stay on," suggested Susan Ellen with delightful readiness. "Can't we have some candy, father?" "Yes, ma'am," said John Hilton, smiling and swinging her hand to and fro as they walked. "I feel as if some would be good myself. What's all this?" They were passing a photographer's doorway with its enticing array of portraits. "I do declare," he exclaimed excitedly, "I'm going to have our pictures taken. 'Twill please your mother more in a little." This was perhaps the greatest triumph of the day, except the delightful meeting with the judge. They sat in a row with the father in the middle, and there was no doubt as to the excellence of the likeness. The best hats had to be taken off because they cast a shadow, but they were not missed, as their owners had feared. Both Susan Ellen and Katie looked their brightest and best. Their eager young faces would forever shine there. The joy of the holiday was mirrored in the little picture. They did not know why their father was so pleased with it. They would not know until age had dowered them with the riches of association and remembrance. Just at nightfall, the Hiltons reached home again, tired out and happy. Katie had climbed over into the front seat beside her father, because that was always her place when they went to church on Sundays. It was a cool evening. There was a fresh sea wind that brought a light mist with it, and the sky was fast growing cloudy. Somehow the children looked different. It seemed to their mother as if they'd grown older and taller since they went away in the morning, and as if they belonged to the town now as much as to the country. The greatness of their day's experience had left her far behind. The day had been silent and lonely without them, and she had had their supper ready and been watching anxiously ever since 5 o'clock. As for the children themselves, they had little to say at first. They had eaten their luncheon early on the way to Topham. Susan Ellen was childishly cross, but Katie was pathetic and wan. They could hardly wait to show the picture, and their mother was as much pleased as everybody had expected. "There, what did make you wear your shawl?" she exclaimed a moment afterward reproachfully. "You ain't been a warm all day long. I wanted folks to see how pretty your new dresses was, if I did make 'em. Well, well, I wish more'n ever now I'd gone to see to ye." "And here's the pepper box," said Katie in a pleased, unconscious tone. "That really is what I call beautiful," said Mrs. Hilton after a long and doubtful look. "Our other one was only tin. I never did look so high as chiny one with flowers, but I can get us another any time for every day. That's a proper hat, as good as you could have got, John. Where's your new hoe?" she asked, as he came toward her from the barn, smiling with satisfaction. "I declare to Moses if I didn't forget all about it," meekly acknowledged the leader of the great excursion. "That and my yellow turnip seed, too. They went clean out of my head. There were so many things to think about. But 'tain't no sort of matter. I can get a hoe just as well to Ira Speed's." His wife could not help laughing. "You and the little girls have had a great time. They was full of wonder to me about everything, and I expect they'll talk about it for a week. I guess we was right about having 'em see something more of the world." "Yes," answered John Hilton with humility. "Yes, we did have a beautiful day. I didn't expect so much. They looked as nice as anybody and appeared so modest and pretty. The little girls will remember it, perhaps, by and by. I guess they won't never forget this day they had along a father." It was evening again. The frogs were piping in the lower meadows, and in the woods, higher up in the great hill, a little owl began to hoot. The sea air, salt and heavy, was blowing in over the country at the end of the hot, bright day. A lamp was lighted in the house. The happy children were chatting together, and supper was waiting. The father and mother lingered for a moment outside and looked down over the shadowy fields. Then they went in without speaking. The great day was over, and they shut the door. And that story was The Hilton's Holiday by Sarah Orne Jewett from The Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Fathers and Daughters, Portraits in Fiction, edited by Terry Eicher and Jesse D. Geller. Appearances by John O'Hara. Howard Ambry stopped the car at the porte cochere to let his wife out, then proceeded to the garage. The MG was already there, the left-hand door was open, and the overhead lamp was burning, indicating that their daughter was home. Ambry put the sedan in its customary place, snapped out the light, rang down the door, and walked slowly toward the house. He stopped midway and looked at the sky. The moon was high and plain, the stars were abundant. In the kitchen, his wife had poured him a glass of milk, which rested on the table with a piece of sponge cake. "I'll be able to play tomorrow after all," said Howard Ambry. "There's hardly a cloud in the sky." "Oh, then you've thought it over," said Lois Ambry. "Thought what over?" "Jack Hill's funeral. You're not going." "Was I thinking it over?" "You said at dinner that you hadn't decided whether to go or not," said Lois Ambry. "That was only because I knew the McIvers planned to go." I don't understand your reasoning, she said. Well, then I'll explain it to you. Peter and Kathy want to go to the funeral. I don't. No reason why I should. But I don't want to inflict my not wanting to go on their wanting to go. Impose, I guess, would be a better word. Influence them. Or, for that matter, take away their pleasure in going to the service. I said I hadn't made up my mind, and so there was no discussion about it. If I'd said I definitely wasn't going, or if I definitely said I wasn't going, they would have wanted to know why. What would you have told them? What would I have told them? I'd have told them that I'd much rather play golf tomorrow. Well, that would have started a discussion all right, she said. I know it would, he said, and I know what the discussion would have been. Wasn't Jack Hill one of my best friends? Couldn't I play golf after the service? And so forth. But I disposed of all that by simply saying I hadn't made up my mind. You disposed of it as far as the MacIvers were concerned, but will you tell me why you're not going? I don't mind telling you. In the first place, I've never considered Jack Hill one of my best friends. He wasn't. He was a lifelong acquaintance, a contemporary. Our families were always friends or friendly. And if you wanted to stretch a point, we were related. All of which you know. But in a town this size, at least until just before the war, damn near everybody is related in some way or other. Yes, and damn near everybody will be at that funeral tomorrow, she said. Therefore, your absence will be noticed. Maybe it will. I thought of that. But the fact is, I never liked Jack, and he never liked me. If the circumstances were reversed, I'm sure he'd be playing golf tomorrow. There won't be many more days we can play this year. I noticed, driving by this afternoon, they've taken the pins out of the cups, and I wouldn't be surprised if they filled in the holes. The golf shop is boarded up for the winter. In fact, Charlie closed up a week ago and went to Florida. I hope there's enough hot water for a shower. I hate to come in after playing golf in this weather and find no hot water. You're playing in the morning, she said. Playing in the morning. We're meeting at 10 o'clock, playing 18 holes. Having something to eat, probably the usual club sandwiches, and then playing bridge. I'll be home around 5, I should think. Who are you playing with? Same 3 I play with every Saturday, and they won't be missed at Jack's funeral. No, they certainly won't be. None of Jack's old friends, and none of your old friends either. Not in that foursome. Lois, you talk as though the whole of Suffolk County were going to be at the church tomorrow, checking to see who stayed away. Are you going to the funeral? Yes, I'm going, or I was. I don't know whether I want to go without you. Oh, hell, call up somebody and go with them. No, if you're not going, I won't. That would make your not going so much more noticeable. Where's Howard? Playing golf. Listen, I'm not going, so don't try to persuade me. I think you ought to go, she said. No. I'll make one more try. I'm asking you to go, she said. And my answer is, I think you're being goddamn unreasonable about this. Jack Hill and I have known each other for over 50 years. We were thrown together by age and financial circumstances. His family and my family had about the same amount of dough. But when we got older and could choose our friends, he never chose me and I never chose him. We were never enemies, but maybe if we had been, we'd have found out why we didn't like each other. Then maybe we could have been friends. But we never had any serious quarrel. We never had a goddamn thing. He was an usher at our wedding. I knew you'd bring that up. That was 25 years ago, and I had to have him, and he had to have me because our parents were friends. It was one of those automatic things in a small town. I couldn't ask one of the clammers, and he couldn't ask one of the potato farmers, but that's all it was. And since you bring that up, about being ushers, Celia didn't ask me to be a pallbearer or whatever the hell she's having. Celia has more sense about this than you have. There aren't going to be any pallbearers, and you know it. All right, I do know it. And she's very sensible, Celia. I'm asking you again, Howard, please, put off your golf till after lunch and go to this funeral with me. It isn't much to ask. But why do you care so much whether I go or not? Because I don't want Celia knowing that you stayed away. Oh, Christ, all right. Although, why you care what Celia knows or doesn't know? You and Celia were never that good friends. But you will go? Yes, I said I would, and I will. But you certainly screwed up my weekend. You can play in the afternoon and Sunday. Father O'Sullivan can't play Saturday afternoon. He has to hear confessions, and he can't play Sunday at all. And Joe Bushmill is going skeet shooting this Sunday. It's not only my schedule you loused up. I'm sorry about that, Howard, but I do appreciate it. Oh, sure, you have no idea how you complicate things. We had to get a fourth for bridge because O'Sullivan has to be in church at 3 o'clock, and now they'll have to get someone to take my place at golf and bridge. I'll do something for you sometime. Why didn't you make your big pitch before tonight? Because I took for granted that you'd be going to the funeral. I just took it for granted. I suppose the same way that people took for granted that Jack Hale was a friend of mine. Well, he wasn't. I'm going to bed. Oh, Amy's home. The MG's in the garage. I know. Good night, dear. Good night, he said, and he bent down and kissed her cheek. Light showed on the floor beneath Amy's bedroom door, and he knocked gently. Amy, you awake? He said softly. Father, come in. She was sitting up in bed, and when he entered, she took off her reading glasses. Hi, she said. What are you reading? He said. Detective story. Who won? Oh, your mother and I took them. We always do at their house, and they usually win when they come here. He sat down on the chaise lounge. As Mr. McCaffrey says, what kind of a day it's been today. Fridays are always easier than other days. The children seem to behave better on Friday. That is, their behavior is better, probably because they're in a better mood. Their schoolwork isn't as good, but you can't have everything. Do you like teaching? Not very much, but I like the children. Well, it's nice having you home for a year. Thank you, Father. It's nice being home. Is it? He said. Have a cigarette? She held up a package. No, thanks. You didn't answer my question. I know I didn't. Yes, it's nice being home. But that's as far as you'll commit yourself, he said. That's as far as I want to commit myself. You mean you don't want to think more deeply than that? Yes, I guess that's what I mean. I'm comfortable here. I have my job, my car to run around in, and I have no idea we had so many detective stories. This one was copyrighted 1924. They are some older than that, early Mary Roberts Reinhardt, he said. Believe I will have one of your cigarettes. He caught the pack she tossed him and lit a cigarette. Are you making any plans for next year? Not exactly. I may get married again, I may not. This time you ought to have children right away. It wouldn't be so good if I had a child now, would it? It might have kept you together, Amy, a child. We had you the first year, your mother and I. Father, you're practically implying that if you hadn't had me. I know what I'm implying, he said, and I know you're no fool. You know it's often been touch and go with your mother and I. You've seen that. I guess it is with everybody, but a child wouldn't have kept Dave and me together. Nothing would. Well, what really separated you? Well, it wasn't his fault. I fell in love with someone else. The man you're thinking of marrying? No. The man you're thinking of marrying is that doctor in Greenport? Yes. But the man you left Dave for was someone else? Yes. And what's happened to him? He's gone out of your life? She looked at him sharply. Yes. Why? Was he married? Yes. Where did you know him? At Cornell? No, Father, and don't ask me any more questions, please. You voluntarily said you wouldn't ask me any questions. You promised that when I came home after my divorce. I did, but with the understanding that when you were ready to tell us, you would. It isn't just idle curiosity, Amy. Your mother and I have a right to know these things, if only to keep you from making the same mistakes all over again. I won't make that mistake over again, and I'm not ready to tell you what happened to me with Dave. As far as I know, Dave was a hell of a nice boy. He was and is, but I wasn't a hell of a nice girl. No father likes to face that fact about his daughter, but there it is. You're not a tart. You're not a chippy. No, but that's not all there is besides virgins, Father. Oh, I know that. Well, when does a girl get to be a tart, in your estimation? Is it a question of how many men she sleeps with? It most certainly is, yes. How many? Yes, I walked into that one, didn't I? Well, a girl who sleeps with more than 2 men before she gets married, she's on her way. I can see a girl having an affair the first time she thinks she's in love, and then the second time when she's more apt to be really in love. But the next time she better be damn sure, or she's going to be a pushover for everybody. Well, that's more or less my record. The second time was also the man I left Dave for. Oh, you had an affair and married Dave and continued to have this other affair? Yes. What's going to prevent you having an affair with the same guy after you marry your doctor? You had an affair with a married man before you married Dave. He sounds like a real son of a bitch. I guess maybe he was, although I didn't think so. I guess he was, though. You're not still seeing him? No, I did after I divorced Dave, but not after I began dating the doctor. You're, to use an old-fashioned word, faithful to the doctor? Oh, you're so smart, Father. You've tricked me into admitting I'm having an affair with the doctor. The answer is yes. Hell, I knew you were probably having an affair with the doctor. I'm no fool either, you know. Well, it's been a very interesting conversation between father and daughter. It's a good thing I'm not my father, or you'd be, well, you wouldn't be here. No, but we wouldn't have had this conversation either. You may have a point. Good night, dear. He kissed her cheek and she squeezed his hand. There is that, he said. We wouldn't have had this conversation. Good night again. Good night, father, she said. The girl sat in her bed, holding her glasses loosely with her right hand, her book with her left, both hands lying on the pink comforter. Her mother came in. What was that all about? Asked Lois Ambry. Our conversation? Oh, mostly about Dave and me. He didn't say anything about Jack Hill? No. I'll be glad when Jack is buried and out of the way. I know, said Amy. Your father's getting closer to the truth, Amy. I guess he is. I had a very difficult time persuading him to go to the funeral tomorrow. Why did you bother? Appearances. Why didn't Howard Ambry go to Jack Hill's funeral? They'd be talking about that for a month, and somebody be sure to say something to Celia, and then Celia'd start asking herself questions. I wonder. I think Mrs. Hill stopped asking questions a long time ago. She should have. I wasn't the only one he played around with. You can be so casual about it, played around with, and you haven't shown the slightest feeling about him, his dying. I didn't show any because I haven't got any, other than relief. I'm not grief-stricken that he died, Mother. As long as he was alive, I was afraid to marry Joe. Now I think I can marry Joe and settle down in Greenport and be what I always wanted to be. But not while Jack was alive. That's the effect he had on me. He was no good, said Lois Ambry. Strange how your father knew that without knowing why. I know why, said Amy. Jack was the kind of man that husbands are naturally suspicious of. Father was afraid Jack would make a play for you. Instead, he made a play for me, but Father never gave that a thought. I suppose so. And in your father's eyes, it would have been just as bad for me to cover up for you as it would have been for me to have had an affair with Jack. I'll be glad when he's out of the way. Really glad when you can marry Joe. Did you go over and call on Mrs. Hill? I went over this afternoon, but she wasn't seeing anyone, fortunately. She is grief-stricken? I don't think it's that. No, I don't think it's that. As you said a moment ago, Celia probably stopped asking questions a long time ago. I'd put it another way, that she's known for years about Jack. Now she doesn't want to see anybody because whatever she's feeling, she doesn't want anybody to see her. Grief or relief. Maybe she doesn't even know yet what she feels. Fear, maybe. Whatever he was, she stuck with him all those years, and suddenly he's gone and she's 52 or 3. I don't know what's in Celia's mind, but I'm glad I'm not her. Did you see Joe tonight? Yes, I had dinner with him. We had dinner at his sister's house in Southold. Spaghetti. She's a very good cook. That will be quite something, an Ambry marrying an Italian boy. Will you have to turn Catholic? I will if he wants me to, if it means that much to him. I'm not sure it does, but it would probably make a difference to his family. Can he marry a divorced woman? I have no idea what the Catholic Church says on that. We haven't discussed it, so I don't know either. Your father's great friends with the new Catholic priest, O'Sullivan. They play golf and bridge together every Saturday. So I gather, when the time comes, whatever they say, I'll do. It would be quite a feather in their cap, an Ambry turning Catholic. They may not see it that way. I understand they can be very tough about some things. Well, I suppose it's their turn. Goodness knows I still can't use to the idea of having one in the White House. Can I get you a glass of milk or anything? No thanks, Mother. Then I guess I'll be off to bed. Mother? What? I'm sorry I caused you and Father so much trouble. You especially. All those lies you had to tell. Oh, that's all right. It's over now. And it was really harder on your father. He never knew why he didn't like that man. And you couldn't tell him, could you, Mother? What? Oh, Mother. Lois Ambry looked at her daughter. Is that another detective story you're reading? You mustn't get carried away, Amy. She smiled. Good night, dear, she said, and closed the door. And that story was Appearances by John O'Hara from Fathers and Daughters, Portraits in Fiction, edited by Terry Eicher and Jesse D. Geller. The next story is from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Chapard and James Thomas. Sleepy Time Gal by Gary Gildner. In the small town in northern Michigan where my father lived as a young man, he had an Italian friend who worked in a restaurant. I will call his friend Phil. Phil's job in the restaurant was as ordinary as you can imagine, from making coffee in the morning to sweeping up at night. But what was not ordinary about Phil was his piano playing. On Saturday nights, my father and Phil and their girlfriends would drive 10 or 15 miles to a roadhouse by a lake where they would drink beer from the Shoopers and dance, and Phil would play an old beat-up piano. He could play any song you named, my father said, but the song everyone waited for was the one he wrote, which he would always play at the end before they left to go back to the town. And everyone knew, of course, that he had written the song for his girl, who was as pretty as she was rich. Her father was a banker in the town, and he was a tough old German, and he didn't like Phil going around with his daughter. My father, when he told the story, which was not often, would tell it in an offhand way and emphasize the depression and not having much instead of the important parts. I will try to tell it the way he did if I can. So they would go to the roadhouse by the lake, and finally Phil would play his song, and everyone would say, "Phil, that's a great song. You could make a lot of money from it." But Phil would only shake his head and smile and look at his girl. I have to break in here and say that my father, a gentle but practical man, was not inclined to emphasize the part about Phil looking at his girl. It was my mother who said the girl would rest her head on Phil's shoulder while he played, and that he got the idea for the song from the pretty way she looked when she got sleepy. My mother was not part of the story, but she heard it when she and my father were younger and therefore had that information. I would like to intrude further and add something about Phil writing the song, maybe show him whistling the tune and going over the words slowly and carefully to get the best ones while peeling onions or potatoes in the restaurant. But my father's already driving them home from the roadhouse and saying how patched up his tires were and how his car's engine was a gingerbread of parts from different makes, and some parts were his own invention as well. And my mother is saying that the old German had made his daughter promise not to get involved with any man until after college, and they couldn't be late. Also, my mother likes the sad parts and is eager to get to their last night before the girl goes away to college. So they all went out to the roadhouse, and it was sad. The women got tears in their eyes when Phil played her song, my mother said. My father said that Phil spent his week's pay on a new shirt and tie, the first tie he ever owned, and people kidded him. Somebody piped up and said, "Phil, you ought to take that song down to Bay City," which was like saying New York City to them, only more realistic, "and sell it and take the money and go to college too." Which was not meant to be cruel, but that was the result because Phil had never even got to high school. But you can see people were trying to cheer him up, my mother said. Well, she'd come home for Thanksgiving and Christmas and Easter, and they'd all sneak out to the roadhouse and drink beer from Shoopers and dance, and everything would be like always. And of course, there were the summers, and everyone knew Phil and the girl would get married after she made good her promise to her father, because you could see it in their eyes when he sat at the old beat-up piano and played her song. That last part about their eyes was not, of course, in my father's telling, but I couldn't help putting it in there, even though I know it is making some of you impatient. Remember that this happened many years ago in the woods by a lake in northern Michigan, before television. I wish I could put more in, especially about the song and how it felt to Phil to sing it, and how the girl felt when hearing it and knowing it was hers. But I've already intruded too much in a simple story that isn't even mine. Well, here's the kicker part. Probably by now, many of you have guessed that one vacation near the end, she didn't come home to see Phil, because she meets some guy at college who's good-looking and as rich as she is, and because her father knew about Phil all along and was pressuring her into forgetting about him. She gives in to this new guy and goes to his hometown during the vacation and falls in love with him. That's how the people in town figured it, because after she graduates, they turn up, already married, and right away he takes over the old German's bank and buys a new Pontiac at the place where my father is the mechanic and pays cash for it. The paying cash always made my father pause and shake his head and mention again that times were tough, But here comes this guy in a spiffy white shirt with French cuffs, my mother said, and pays the full price in cash. And this made my father shake his head, too. Phil took the song down to Bay City and sold it for $25, the only money he ever got for it. It was the same song we just heard on the radio and which reminded my father of the story I just told you. What happened to Phil? Well, he stayed in Bay City and got a job managing a movie theater. My father saw him there after the Depression when he was on his way to Detroit to work for Ford. He stopped and Phil gave him a box of popcorn. The song he wrote for the girl had sold many millions of records, and if I told you the name of it, you could probably sing it, or at least whistle the tune. I wonder what the girl thinks when she hears it. Oh, yes, my father met Phil's wife, too. She worked in the movie theater with him, selling tickets and cleaning the carpet after the show with one of those sweepers you push. She was also big and loud, and nothing like the other one, my mother said. And that story was Sleepy Time Gal, from Gary Gildner, from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.